Welcome to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. The Alaska Supreme Court is the highest level of state court. It hears appeals from the lower state courts and also administers the state's judicial system. Today, we have the opportunity to speak with the Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court, Justice Craig Stowers. I'd like to invite my co-host and legal expert, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews, here in the studio with me today to go ahead and introduce our guest.
Thanks so much, Kathleen. It's a real pleasure to have Justice Stowers here. Justice Stowers was appointed to the court as a judge first in 2004 as a trial judge, and then he was appointed to the Alaska Supreme Court in 2009 by Governor Sean Parnell. He was elected by his colleagues to be Chief Justice in 2015, and Chief Justices serve for a three-year term. So, Justice Stowers, it's a pleasure to have you here, and we're so glad you've made the time to join us.
Well, thank you for asking me to come. It's a privilege, and I want to wish you both a very happy Solstice Day. It's a beautiful day outside, and here we are sitting in the basement.
Without a window. Yes, we did enjoy the view as we walked in. It was nice. Yes. Well, great. May I throw out our phone numbers?
Certainly.
We do invite our listeners to participate in the program with us, and you know, if you have questions or observations about the Alaska court system and the work of the Chief Justice, we'd love to hear from you. It's a rare opportunity to have the Chief Justice on the radio, and we're really thrilled to have you. And we hope that our listeners take advantage of the opportunity to ask you what's on their minds. So let me throw out the numbers. Here in Anchorage, it's 550-8433. Statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752. And we'd also welcome your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So let's get started.
So, Justice Stowers, I think that most people don't know judges, and when they think of judges, they think of a nameless person in many ways in a black robe, and I'm not sure that they know much about who our judges are and how they came to be judges, and you have an interesting history. So I'm wondering if you're willing to share with Alaskans who might be listening how it is you came from the East Coast to be the Chief Justice of the state of Alaska. It's a pretty interesting and long winding story, and I wonder if you can give us just a little insight as to how you find yourself here.
I did most of my growing up as a kid in Yorktown, Virginia. My dad moved me and my younger sister to Virginia when I was five after my mom died. He located us in Yorktown, which is a small town, about 350 people, in the middle of a national park. Colonial National Historical Park was established to preserve both the Revolutionary War battlefields where General Washington defeated Lord Cornwallis in 1776, and also part of the park is Jamestown and the original town site where the first permanent English settlement in America was established. In that park exists basically to provide access to that knowledge and that experience to the American people. So I was surrounded by early American history. My dad remarried, and because I tend to be a headstrong, ornery type person, at least I was when I was a kid, my wife would tell you I still am.
She's going to call in.
Yeah, and I'm going to pay for that later. My stepmom and I did not get along. And to make a long story short, and certainly I did not make it easy for her. But, I mean, she was doing her best to try to, you know, be my new mom, and I was having none of it.
How old were you? Well, it happened at five, but the marriage didn't happen. The second mom didn't arrive till
a year or two later.
So you were still really a young youngster.
Rebellious beyond my years. Anyway, one of the things that she conceived to manage a headstrong kid was to send him to military school for a couple of years. After about 3 years, I decided that that was not a good idea, so I managed to get myself expelled and came back home.
Headstrong. I sense headstrong.
Yep. Okay. I actually was placed with some foster parents for a year, and then ultimately somehow managed to arrange to end that relationship and came back home and then got kicked out, and I ended up living in the basement of one of the Park Service colonial buildings that had not been rehabilitated, and just learned early how to fend for myself. I ended up skipping my 12th grade of high school and going directly to a college in Illinois, which had a work program where every student, and it was a residential campus, every student on campus was required to work a job in every building on that campus that exists, has been built by students, all the food prepared by students. I mean, anything that it takes to operate and manage a college is done by student labor.
Was that a way to make it affordable?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was the reason I went there, because, I mean, I was just a kid trying to figure out what I was going to do.
So. And you probably were, it was on you to pay forever whatever college you managed to get through?
Me and the labor of working at the college. It was a great college. I should shout it out. Blackburn College in Carlinville, Illinois.
How big is it? Is it still there today?
It is. I think at the time I was there, we had 300, 350 residential students. Carlinville is the capital, if you will, of Macoupin County, which Mark Twain wrote about in one of his Mississippi River stories.
Mm. So what did you major in?
I majored in biology. As a result of me growing up in Yorktown and the park there, when I was in high school, one of the jobs I had was to work for the park as a high school student in the summer, doing trails maintenance, groundskeeping, and things like that. Then when I was in college, I continued working for the park in the summer as a seasonal interpreter. And so I would be one of the young people in a park ranger uniform with a Smokey the Bear hat taking people on tours, at the Jamestown town site, for example.
Right.
I worked for Jewel Cave National Monument for two summers in college doing spelunking, which is caving. And we did both exploration, mapping of the cave. It's one of the unknown treasures of the national park system. You know, its sister park is Wind Cave in South Dakota, but Jewel Cave is in the Black Hills, and it's by far and away the most extraordinary cave, I think, in the park system.
Well, I was surprised to read on your resume that you were a ranger at Denali National Park.
That's what brought me here. After college and around the bicentennial time in 1976, I got on permanently with the Park Service, and I was doing law enforcement, rescue work, and things like that on the parkway. And after the bicentennial was over, which was a big deal for the cannonball parks out east, I got a transfer to what was then Mount McKinley National Park. And I stayed there 5 years as the East District Naturalist first, and then as the West District Ranger. And then I lost my mind and decided it would be a good idea to give up the best job I ever had to go to law school.
Wow. And so did you think you'd be an environmental lawyer, or did you, even though you're going to sort of marry this park background and ranger background with the law, what did you see yourself doing after law school?
Well, I can tell you what I did not see myself doing, and that was to be a lawyer. I had no interest in actually practicing law. I thought I would take my biology background, my natural resources experience as a ranger, and the knowledge I would get through the study of law, and go do natural resources policy type work. As it turns out, after law school, I was fortunate to have two clerkships, one with Judge Buchiever, who was the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals judge in Juneau, and then with Justice Warren Matthews, who was on the Alaska Supreme Court. And I started looking at jobs with some of the environmental organizations that were around then, thinking I could do policy work, but what they really were looking for was a lawyer who was interested in practicing law, doing litigation, and that wasn't a skill set I had, so I ended up going to work for a law firm here in town, Atkinson, Conway, and Gagnon, excuse me, and much to my surprise, I found out that I actually enjoyed the practice of law and trial work especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so eventually, you became first a trial judge, so that's at the Superior Court level in Anchorage.
That's right.
And how would you contrast your work as a trial judge with your job as an appellate judge? I mean, they're two very different things.
I loved the trial court, and my colleagues tease me even today. You know, the first bad day I have, I'm going to go back and start doing trial work again.
You liked it.
I did. I think that I have a real sense of compassion for people, and I like working with real people who have real problems in real time. And on the appellate court, you don't get to work with people.
You know, you work with issues, right?
Well, you're working with their record. You know, the trial has been done. The transcript of the trial is prepared. The briefs are done, both the trial court briefs and also the appellate briefs. And then we're evaluating whether a trial judge made a mistake. I mean, that's really what the appellate work mostly is about. You know, one party, the losing party. The losing party thinks that the reason they lost is the trial judge made a mistake. Sometimes trial judges do make mistakes. We're all human. I mean, my colleagues aren't going to like me to say this, but, you know, sometimes maybe we make mistakes on the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. But we try really hard not to. And I think for the most part, we have just an excellent judiciary in Alaska at every court level. We have judges that are caring and committed, thoughtful, and they work really hard. And I think Alaskans can be very proud of the work that the judges do, generally speaking.
You know, Elaine sort of pioneered this program, Justice Alaska, and I wondered why you came on. I mean, Chief Justices don't always come on the air and talk about how tough it is to make these decisions or even some of the things we'll talk about during the hour. Why did you decide to come on?
Well, the first reason is that Elaine is a very persuasive individual, and she asked me to come on, and I've never told her no. But
you have to stay in good standing with Justice.
Indeed. The bigger reason is I think that all judges have a responsibility to educate and communicate with our public, the citizens that are here. And this is an opportunity for me to share some of my thoughts about what the court system is, what it does, to answer people's questions, if anyone has any that I'm able to answer, and, of course, to answer your questions.
Sure. That's great. Well, I appreciate it, and I should throw our numbers out just one more time here, so we can do that, 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 in statewide, or email at hometown@alaskapublic.org.
So let me ask you, Justice Stowers, you have a couple different roles. Obviously, you are one of five justices on the Alaska Supreme Court, but you're also the Chief Justice. Maybe if you could give us maybe just a slice of what a justice on the Alaska Supreme Court does on a day-to-day basis and what your work looks like. And then at some point we can say, and in addition to that, then maybe you can tell us what you do as the Chief Justice that is different than what the other justices do.
Sure. So the vast majority of the work of a justice is essentially to decide cases, and we decide cases collectively. So we have an appeal that comes up from the trial courts. It is assigned randomly to one of the five of us, and that justice, along with the help of law clerks, will evaluate the entire case. The parties identify issues that they think are being presented, but we also have to look at the whole case because sometimes there are other issues that weren't decided that really needed to be. For example, the trial court may not have had jurisdiction to hear the case in the first place, and an entire trial happened, and yet the court was without jurisdiction. No party recognized it. Perhaps the judge didn't recognize it. And, you know, we evaluate to make sure that, you know, there was this threshold requirement met. But most cases, you know, the lawyers correctly identify the issues, and you know, we work up the case, and we essentially decide, did the trial judge correctly decide the case? In addition to that, there are, I mean, on any given week, dozens of motions and petitions and side work that is invisible, I think, to most of the public and probably most of even the lawyers that work in the trial courts, at least. And then we have lots of committee work. Every justice either chairs or sits on several committees that help advance the interest of justice in Alaska.
You know, we've got a caller. Would it be a good time to bring him on? I'd like to welcome Max. Hi, Max. You're on Justice Alaska. What's your question?
Hi, I am here. I know my name is hard to spell, so maybe it was difficult for anybody to figure out who it was, but this is Max. Thank you.
Hi, Max.
My question has to do with the federal and the state Supreme Court system. We have had an extended period without a properly imbalanced federal Supreme Court, and that's through the actions of lawmakers. What's the long and the short effect on that, and was it right? Is there a way that should have been pushed through so that we would have gotten another Supreme Court justice without waiting months as we have?
Okay.
Max, thank you for the question. It's a really interesting question, and it's a controversial one. And, of course, it deals with federal law and the federal system. I can take a stab at answering it generally. And my answer is this. You know, when the founders of the national system wrote our national constitution, you know, they put in a provision that while the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary is the third branch of government there, just as the judiciary is here, their process for selecting justices is different than ours. And the Constitution provides that the Senate is required and permitted to give its advice and consent. But what that means is open to some discussion, as I know you know. And in this case, President Obama nominated a jurist to fill that Supreme Court vacancy, and the Senate, in its wisdom, decided, or at least the majority, decided that they weren't going to give their advice and consent, and I know that they had strategic reasons for doing that. I can't sit here and say whether that's right or wrong. I can just observe that it's a fact. And
that's not how we do it in Alaska.
No, it's not.
Which might be worth pointing out to folks just a little bit.
So I'm a big proponent of Alaska's system of choosing judges. When the constitutional delegates who met to draft Alaska's constitution deliberated on this, they decided that they wanted a judiciary selection process that was based on merit and not based on political considerations. And so they decided they did not want their judges elected. In some states, judges are elected just as representatives or senators or city council people are elected. In Alaska, any lawyer can apply to be a judge at any level, and that individual then has to run the gauntlet, as I like to say. They provide an enormous amount of personal and professional information, financial information. They sign waivers so that the Alaska Judicial Council can evaluate their qualifications and make recommendations. The Judicial Council is also a creature of the Alaska Constitution, and it is a body of seven individuals. Three are lawyers appointed by or determined by the Alaska Bar Association. Three are citizens nominated and appointed by the governor. And then the Chief Justice, by virtue of being Chief Justice, is the ex officio member and votes only when there is a tie and the vote would make a difference. And the investigation, the deliberation, takes an enormous amount of time, both on behalf of the staff of the Alaska Judicial Council, but also on behalf of the real unsung heroes, who are the council members themselves, who spend not hours and not days, but weeks of time, weeks and weeks of time, evaluating the voluminous material that's provided to them, and then also interviewing each and every candidate, participating in public hearings where the public in each community that's affected has an opportunity to testify, and then ultimately deliberating and making recommendations to the governor.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask, just because I'm skipping ahead now to your role as Chief Justice rather than simply a justice doing the work of the appellate court. I mean, you have this other enormous job, and this year it's been an unbelievable number of judicial vacancies that needed to be filled. And we were talking yesterday, you and the council members have been all over the state in the last couple of weeks. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Of course. There have been an unusually large number of vacancies that have occurred in the judiciary in different court locations and at different court levels, you know, for a whole variety of reasons. Our Alaska Constitution requires that a judge retire from active service when the judge hits age 70, and so in some cases, you know, once you hit 70, you're out. Some judges or justices decide even before they hit 70 that for personal reasons, you know, they want to have a life, because it's hard to have a life as a judge because of the workload, and so they would retire a little earlier. And you know, former Chief Justice Dana Fabe, who served a long, long time, I mean, she certainly deserved it. It wasn't like she was slacking. We got a lot of work out of her before she retired, and then she was replaced by Justice Susan Carney from Fairbanks. In the work that the council has done more recently, we were in Palmer and in Juneau last September, just a couple of months ago, and because there were vacancies on the Palmer Superior Court and the Juneau District Court. And then almost 3 weeks ago, the council spent 2 days in Kenai, a day in Bethel, 2 days in Dillingham, and a day in Nome, because there are vacancies coming up due to retirements by Superior Court judges in those four communities. And so we were interviewing.
On the road. You've been on the road.
On the road and in
or
the
in
air.
Or in the air. Right.
Absolutely.
You know, I saw some of the news coverage about that and some of the very heartfelt testimony coming from the public who come out in these smaller communities to tell you and the Judicial Council what they're looking for in a judge. What was it like to be there and hear that?
I've got to say, honestly, that was the most powerful part of the entire experience was, you know, we would go to these communities and, you know, the Judicial Council will put out notices in advance, and so it's in the press, it's in the media, word of mouth, and members of the public would come and testify, sometimes in favor of a particular candidate, sometimes against a candidate, sometimes just to tell the council, this is the kind of person we're looking for to be a judge in our community. And we had leaders from the Native villages, from Native corporations, healthcare corporations, a mayor of a town, and everyday citizens just come in and say, you know, we are a rural community. We're really looking for a judge who is sensitive to cross-cultural issues, you know, to the interest and the issues and the culture of the Native peoples that live in this community. We want a judge that, you know, will be respectful to us. We want a judge that will be respectful to the court employees at the courthouse. And, of course, my response to all of that is yes and amen. That's exactly what we want also. But to hear that real heartfelt expression of caring and concern, it touched me deeply. I am a proud member of the Anchorage community. And we, a couple of days ago, met again, the Judicial Council met again to interview for candidates for a Court of Appeals position. And notices went out and publication was made asking for public input.
So all these meetings are open, is that?
They're totally open. And it saddens me to say that we had one citizen from Anchorage show up to our courtroom to testify about a Court of Appeals judge. In Nome and in Dillingham, the community filled the courtroom in those communities. And so, I mean, my hat's off to those communities and to Anchorage. I've got to think about a way to communicate with my fellow Anchorage citizens to see if we can get the word out better.
Well, that makes me think of two questions that we talked about briefly yesterday. One is the diversity on the court. You know, how does the judicial system reflect the community of Alaska? And, you know, do you have thoughts about that? The second one is a judge being of the community, but also distant from the community. So what a challenge it is in a state like Alaska when we are not homogenized. We're geographically diverse. We're, you know, ethnically diverse, all kinds of diversity. And how does someone land in a community like that and become part of the community and yet still have the distance so that people have confidence in their decisions? So those are two questions. One is, let's tackle the diversity one first.
All right, thank you. You ask, how does the judiciary reflect the community as a whole? And my honest answer is it doesn't. It doesn't. And one of the big reasons why is that, you know, if we were going to have a judiciary that really reflected, say, proportionally, you know, the makeup of our state, we would have a lot more, probably at least 20% of our judiciary would be native jurists, Alaska Native jurists. And at this point in our history, there are just simply not very many Alaska Native lawyers. And to be a judge in the state court system, to be, you know, you must be a lawyer first. So, you know, we ask ourselves why, and I know that the Native community also is very interested in this, and there's lots of initiatives and lots of programs, and the court system is deeply involved also in trying to change this statistic and to encourage members of other communities, the Native community included, to think about going into law and then ultimately think about becoming a judge. And so, for example, the court system has what we call a Color of Justice program, where we either go into the schools throughout the state, or they come to us, depending on where we're putting the program on. And we just try to get students acquainted with the legal system and acquainted with what it might be like to be a judge. And, you know, time will tell if we ultimately succeed. But, I mean, we're starting, you know, at the lowest common denominator in terms of trying to encourage those thoughts. We've got a long way to go. I will say that the relative proportion of women as compared to men in the judiciary, I mean, it's ebbed and flowed, you know, but we are having currently in our history more women appointed to the bench, and that's a good thing because people bring with them their life experiences and their life views, and there are things in the world that I'm sorry to say I can't see or understand nearly as well as Judge Andrews can, because she has a different perspective and a different life experience. And ultimately, you want to have a judiciary that has as much of variety or diversity in those kinds of experiences and perceptions, because ultimately, you know, what we do, although we're dealing with case-by-case kinds of issues, it all has an impact and an effect.
I'm going to invite a caller on, and we'll go back to part two of my question. Sure. Paul, welcome to Justice Alaska. What's your question?
Well, in speaking to the issue of public input, you know, with like zoning issues and things like that, we can often make comments online, and that's helpful. And if that feature were available to put public comment into, you know, any kind of issue like selecting judges or whatever. That would make things easy.
Is there not? I think there is a way. Is there not to comment on judges?
Yes, absolutely.
If you don't mind,
go ahead. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah. And then another issue I've seen with public hearings is a lot of times they're held during the day, during working hours, and that makes it difficult for anybody but professionals and people who actually do it for a living to come to those meetings. And you know, so that and I don't know when public hearings are held for these sorts of appointments, you know, whether or not that's taken into consideration or not. I didn't really have a question. I just had a couple of comments.
Well, that's great. We'll try to deal with the two things that you've raised. How does someone know when the hearings are, and is there a way to comment on judges? And
sure.
Let's dive in.
So thank you, Paul. You make really good point, and we actually think about that. We here in Anchorage, because it turned out that the public hearing was going to have to be held on a Monday this time around, so that's not a weekend day, obviously. We picked the noon hour thinking that, you know, to the extent that people have a more or less normal work day, it would be easier for people to get off at noon and testify. In some of these other communities, for example, in Kenai, you know, we had public hearing on a weekend day. It turned out to be on a Sunday, and you know, people did show up. It's one of those difficult things because whatever time we pick, some people will be able to make it and some won't. But if you have a specific idea, please email the Alaska Judicial Council, and you can Google that and get the email address, and we'd be happy to look at that.
Elaine, I'm remembering back to an early show we had on Justice Alaska about how judges are selected, and I thought there was an opportunity for people to file comments.
There is. As Justice Stowers points out, the Alaska Judicial Council solicits comments. So you can go to that website, and you can comment online. You can send in emails and comment on a judge. I think the idea of having some kind of real-time situation might be an interesting. I think there's a lot of technology we could use to, increase public participation.
Facilitate.
And I think that's Paul has come up with some great questions. And I know Justice Stowers is absolutely committed to getting as much public participation as we possibly can.
No, it's really true. I mean, not only via email, but you can use the old-fashioned letter,
snail mail.
People have faxed in, or even just delivered. Or telephoned in information.
Mm-hmm.
We are open to any and all input that we can possibly get, because mm-hmm. that is a critical component of how judges are selected, is to get public to tell us, what do you need, what do you think, what do you want, what do you not want?
Mm-hmm. Well, we need to take a little break here. We're going to come back, and we're going to talk about things like how the budget is affecting the judiciary. There are some innovations in the court system that we're going to talk about, including a joint jurisdiction with a tribal court. So we have a lot to talk about. This is Hometown Alaska. It's really Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska right now. And we'll be back in just a moment. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Welcome back to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and we have a special program today, and I'm just going to throw it to my co-host and legal expert, Judge Andrews, to go ahead and reintroduce our special guest today.
So we're talking with Chief Justice Greg Stowers of the Alaska Supreme Court, and we've been talking about one of the many hats he wears as Chief Justice, and that is as the head of the, as the ex officio member of the Judicial Council and involved in judicial selection and retention. But as the Chief Justice, you're the head administrative officer for the court, the head judicial administrative officer. There's an administrative director of the court, but the Supreme Court itself administers the court
judiciary.
System.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so this is a tough time to be the head of a government group in Alaska based on our budget concerns. So as Chief Justice, what are you seeing is happening with the court? What are your thoughts about how we're going to work through this? Because this is a service that cannot be shut down. It's a third branch of government, and it needs to keep rolling.
It's more really than just the third branch of government. The service that the court provides is unique, and no other branch would be able to do that. And that is to give people, businesses, individuals, families, you name it, tribes sometimes, a forum to resolve their disputes. We're talking legal disputes, but sometimes you're basically talking things like custody of children. You're talking about fitness of parents. You're talking about someone alleging that somebody else breached a contract and money is owed or services are rendered. And without a court system to be able to provide an arena where people can have their disputes resolved peaceably under the rule of law, then we're looking at anarchy, frankly. And, harkening back to growing up in Yorktown, Virginia, just having – instilled in me, you know, the values of our democracy writ large in America. You know, the court system, in my view, and I'll be the first to admit I'm biased here, provides that place where people can come and, you know, be treated fairly and equally under the law, where laws apply equally to every person. Now, does that work all the time 100%? Probably not, but, you know, we're always going to be a work in progress. Now, getting back to your question, Judge Andrews, being chief right now is challenging because, as everybody knows, Alaska is facing really dire budgetary concerns and restrictions and challenges. And the court system, like every other agency in the government, is having to do its part to figure out how to do what we do and still provide access to justice and public service to our citizens with less money. So when I came on as chief a year and a half ago, the court's budget was $112 million. And some people would hear that and say, holy smokes, that's a lot of money.
$112 million.
Right. And others would look at that and say, that's not very much money at all compared to other agencies, branches of government. The truth is our operating budget is about 1.5% of the total operating budget in the state, of state government. So we're a very thin slice in terms of the cost of doing all that we do. We have courts that are spread from Ketchikan to Barrow, you know, Unalaska, Nome, Anchorage, Fairbanks, you name it. We are all over the place here in the largest state in the country. We have 65 Superior Court or District Court judges, trial court judges. We have 3 Court of Appeals judges and 5 Supreme Court justices. When I started as chief, we had about 750 non-judicial employees, including magistrate judges that are located in various courts, both in the cities and also in the rural courts. Since I've become chief, one of the things we've done is to reduce the size of government. I mean, that's a big push. It's a big theme. You know,
and a necessity, I mean, based on the budget.
And frankly, a necessity. I don't resist the concept. But the reality that people have to accept is if you want to reduce the size of government, you've really got to identify what services and functions do you want to affect, because you can't keep doing the same level of service with less people and less money. So some of the things that we're trying to do is be more efficient with our time and the way that we handle cases. But one of the ways that we're trying to save money is to identify positions that we think we can live without. And so as people, court employees, reach a retirement age or they decide to resign and go do something else, you know, we ask ourselves with each and every employee, is this a position that we can afford not to fill? And we have cut the size of the non-judicial staff in the court system by about 9.3% over the last year and a half to 2 years. That means that while there were 750 people, court staff, there when I started as chief, we're going to be down to about 690 by this coming summer. And for such a small organization, that's a lot of people. I mean, at some point, we're just not going to be able to keep cutting people.
Well, what would people notice?
Well, what they're going to notice is that it's going to take longer to get hearings scheduled on a judge's calendar. One of the other things that we have done, which I think was really innovative and it's tended to work very well, better, frankly, than I expected, we have closed courts Friday afternoon. So at noon on Fridays, every court in the state is closed except for emergency proceedings like domestic violence petitions, you know, child in need of aid, emergency petitions, and things like that.
When did that start?
That started last July 1st.
Okay.
And that saves us on the order of maybe about $2 million. And
in your estimation, has it hurt or have you managed it?
We have managed it well. But the cost, because there's always a cost, is that when you take away from the judges, you know, 3 to 4 hours in the afternoon of trial time, that's that much less time that they've got. And so they're going to have to expand out any given case into the next week, which means they've got less time on their calendars to put new cases on. And so it's going to cause some delay in people getting their cases heard.
Yeah. You know, I want to take just a moment and share our numbers and then take a caller. We'd love to hear from you if you've got questions about how the judiciary can manage the budget or how it is managing it and what it looks like going forward. Give us a call at 550-8433 in Anchorage or send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And I'd like to go ahead and welcome Alice onto Home Justice Alaska. Hi, Alice. Did you have a question for us?
I do. As you were talking about, you know, being more efficient with our, you know, time and budget, you know, concerns, as a concerned citizen, we've been trying to deal with the environmental impact of development in our area, and some of the issues have gone before the court system as far as coal mining. And I'm trying to figure out how would be the most effective way for individual citizens to present their concerns so that the court realizes that, you know, the impact it will actually have on us. We've gone to, you know, our assembly and you know, some of the assembly members have been very supportive, and you know, it's a very long and drawn out process. But when things do get to the court level, as a citizen, I'm not sure how we can be most effective in expressing ourselves.
So that's a very interesting question, and my answer is probably not going to be totally helpful in terms of what you might be looking for. The beauty of having assemblies or the state legislature or other representative bodies to hear citizens' concerns is that the citizens can indeed come and be heard. And you can express your view, you can express your displeasure. If you don't like what you're getting, you can vote and make an effort to try to replace those bodies. The court system, as I'm sure you know, is designed to resolve disputes, and these disputes are brought in an adversarial context. So, you know, your typical case, you've got two parties, and one party wants A, and the other party wants B, and, you know, there is some legal basis for them to be arguing their positions, and they come before a judge or a jury, and they present their facts, they argue the law, and then you get a response. The court system and the court function is not really designed to give input to, you know, the public at large on those kind of issues outside of the context of an actual lawsuit. So, you know, hypothetically, you know, somebody like you or maybe a group that you belong to takes a position on some action that a state agency has taken and you're in disagreement with it, then, you know, your recourse might be first to protest to the agency. The agency will give you some response. You usually have an opportunity to appeal that decision within the agency itself. And then if you're still not happy with the response, then you have the opportunity and the right to appeal to a superior court. And the superior court then would have a regular court hearing. And then the party that loses there then would have a right to appeal finally to the Alaska Supreme Court. It's a long process. It can be an expensive process. But that really is how the courts function, and that's what their role is in helping resolve those kinds of disputes.
Alice, did you have a comeback to that or a thought about that?
Well, I guess, you know, when we do have an agency or a group that would be doing, kind of presenting that before the court, does the court system ask for individuals, or they really are just dealing with the lawyers that represent, just representing the group that is bringing that case. And I guess the other question would be, when you said it's a costly process, as a group of citizens, if we were to get together, you know, if we lose the case, then are we going to, you know, have to you know, mortgage our home to pay legal fees, or how to, you know, I guess that would be my other question. And that's all that I had to ask. Thank you. No,
thanks, Alice.
Thank you, Alice. So, again, a court and a judge can only deal with a case, and a case is a controversy, you know, between two or more parties. And so, in your typical situation, individuals or groups, special interest, don't get a chance to participate unless they are a party
to the lawsuit.
To the lawsuit, or in a rare case, sometimes, you know, special interest groups will seek to become what we call amicus parties, and they will attempt to at least give us a brief, you know, telling us what their position is, and that's done with
people
permission.
People can come in and sit in the courtroom. I know Judge Andrews is always talking about it as available, but it doesn't mean you get to speak, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But you can observe.
Right. And at the obviously at the Supreme Court level, I don't think people understand that the justices don't take testimony. That's a trial court function. So
that's right.
The justices are only reading the transcripts of what was said, and nobody gets to come to the Supreme Court and give them new information because they're deciding what happened
in another court.
But yeah. Obviously at the trial court, if you're called as a witness, you can give information. I really do encourage people to really take advantage of what is the remarkable part of our American judicial system, which is that it's open. I mean, really, except for very few court hearings, usually involving juveniles or probate matters, the courts are open and drama goes on in dozens of different courtrooms every minute of every day. And it's available to come in and watch and see how justice is administered. And I think people would gain a great deal of confidence if they wanted to come down to the courthouse and just take a look.
You know, before we welcomed that call, we were talking about the budget. And it's not just the court system that is tightening its belt. Law enforcement is tightening its belt. And I wonder what the judiciary thinks about, you know, we've got domestic violence issues across our state in every community. With less law enforcement and a smaller judiciary, what does that make the Chief Justice think?
Well, my first thought is everybody is going to be tightening their belts. Every agency, you know, every branch of government is going to have to do that. Law enforcement is spread very thin. Even before the budget crisis, so-called law enforcement was spread very thin. And you have lots of rural villages, communities, that really have very little, and in some cases, no law enforcement presence at all. Now we're presented with a situation where the Department of Public Safety and in communities, you know, the city of Anchorage, municipality of Anchorage, is having to cut back, and one of the ways they're doing that is to reduce the number of law enforcement officers, and in some cases they're trying to reduce their area of patrol responsibility.
Right, there's been a conflict recently.
Big conflict on that locally here. And that's, I mean, frankly scary. I mean, I think all of us want and expect some reasonable level of public safety, and Alaska has terrible statistics on incidents of domestic violence generally and violence against women, homicides and homicides against women, sexual assault. And you have to have resources to be able to help these people, hopefully proactively, but even if you can't be there to prevent it, to be able to respond to it. One of the things that the court system is trying to do is to assist other agencies, including the troopers, the Department of Public Safety, through some of the innovations that we're developing. So we are putting in place, in some cases as a pilot project, video conferencing so that instead of requiring the troopers to transport a prisoner, say, from Fairbanks to Anchorage for what would be, on the scale of things, a relatively de minimis type of a hearing.
De minimis, I'm sorry.
Well, criminal defendants have a constitutional right to be present in person at their trials, at their sentencing. But sometimes there are status conferences, scheduling conferences, and things like that. And especially if the individual defendant waives his or her right to be there, They don't have to be present in the courtroom. They can attend by video link. They can attend by phone. And what we're trying to do, and we have at our expense put in place at Goose Creek and at Anvil Mountain and at a number of other facilities and formerly out at Palmer, video equipment of reasonable quality so that individuals can attend hearings. And that frees up the troopers and other law enforcement from having to transport mm-hmm. them, because there's an expense in the transport, but there's also an expense in taking those officers away from other duties, you know, public safety, for example.
Right.
So we're trying to do our part and cooperate with and collaborate with other agencies to help along those lines.
I wanted to mention, in terms of budget, SB 91 that just passed this year and is not even rolled out yet, it is in the process, is supposed to save a lot of money. What's your take on it? How do you feel about it? Are you waiting to see what happens?
Well, certainly, you know, this is a law that was just passed this last session, and we don't have any real experience with it, and we don't have a lot of data because it hasn't gone into effect fully. There's a significant part of it that's going to become effective January 1st, you know, in a couple of weeks. The theory was based upon experiences that other states have had in attending to criminal justice reform. And in sort of its broadest idea, the notion is that there are criminals who are scary, dangerous, and those are the criminals that probably belong in jail. But there are other criminals that don't have much of a record, you might even call them minor offenders, that perhaps long jail terms aren't really necessary and might actually do more harm, because when you send a youthful offender that doesn't have much of a record, you know, into the big house with a bunch of serious offenders, you know, this is an educational experience for that person too. The part of the idea that will hopefully save money is that as we focus more on rehabilitation and treatment, and we identify correctly those that belong in jail as opposed to those that would do better and ultimately recidivate less by giving them treatment and other options, we reduce the number of people that are going to be needing a jail bed, and mm-hmm. it will reduce costs that way.
Yeah, it's a sort of strategic, trying to use your resources on the...
The data suggests that it worked in the other states that were the models that the Pew group used and that the Criminal Justice Commission studied very carefully. The Criminal Justice Commission, its term has been extended longer than it was originally anticipated so that it can monitor and see how things are going and make recommendations to the legislature if there are things that need to be changed. It's very controversial. You know, my message, I'm not going to tell you how I feel. That's not my job today. But my message to people that are concerned about this is give it some time. You know, and let's look at the response and see if it made sense. I mean, the reason I say that is the data shows that in the states that actually put this in place today, their recidivism rates are down, the costs are down, and many people, not everybody, it's not going to be perfect, but many people are becoming productive members of society again, and I think that's what we all want and hope for.
Yeah.
But it's just too soon right
yeah.
now.
By the way, we off your budget discussion, we have a question, and here it comes. With the downsizing, this is an email question, with the downsizing and lack of funds for courts, do you believe judges will be pressured to dismiss or not hear petitions for appeals? How are you ensuring this doesn't happen?
So the answer is no. They're not going to be pressured to dismiss anything. The judges are both constitutionally required and also morally obligated to do their jobs. And they're not going to get any pressure from me, the court, or anybody. I think where you will see real pressure is going to be in the Department of Law, the district attorneys, municipal attorneys, deciding what cases they are going to ultimately charge and go forward with, because they are also experiencing a huge pressure with less people. They've got less money. And at some point, if it gets bad enough, you know, they're going to be attending to their first priority issues, which are going to be serious felony issues, and they just may not have the resources you know, the personnel to charge the smaller ones.
I would say I think the person who wrote the question needs to understand that the court is in many ways a passive agency. In other words, the Supreme Court, you know, in our state, you have a right to appeal. The Supreme Court can't not take appeals. So if a person has a right to appeal, they need to hear the appeal.
And they don't get to choose. They don't go out and...
They don't, unlike the Supreme Court that grants cert saying we will hear that appeal, our court doesn't have the discretion to limit its caseload that way. And that's also true for the trial judges. I mean, there are judges have the authority to dismiss cases, but it's based on very strict rules and regulations. The judges don't have anything to do with filing cases. So if filings are up, judges have to handle that number of cases. If filings are down, the filings are down. But the judges don't control that. That is, as Justice Stauer suggests, the other agencies.
So do you have one more question?
I do have one I'd like to squeeze in. Just Elaine and I are probably going to have a program on this. I'm talking about the tribal and state joint jurisdiction experiment or opportunity that's going to happen in Kenai. And I think we'll explore it more fully because, as we once again realize, there's not enough time here. But how about a reaction to that, support of those ideas, shared jurisdiction? Joint jurisdiction is what it is.
I am very supportive of the innovative programs and initiatives that the court system and a number of tribal courts around the state are involved in. The real focus on all of these programs, the common theme is restorative justice. And so you have individuals that have committed a crime under state law, but given the level of the crime, they ultimately have an opportunity to go before a village court or a native court, tribal court, if you will. The joint jurisdiction program, and you're talking specifically about the Kenaitse Tribal Court and the Kenai Superior Court, is a therapeutic court model where you have both a state superior court judge and a tribal judge sitting together, rotating back and forth between the state courtroom and the tribal courtroom, dealing with individuals who have committed offenses but also have... So now I've got to stop here because one thing I want to do was to recognize Judge Andrews. I think most people don't realize what a remarkable career she's had as a district court judge, Superior Court judge, pro tem judge. She's a most remarkable person, and we need to put on your website her bio because it's way more interesting than mine.
Okay. All right. Well, on that note, I'm going to have to wind this up. And this is our monthly edition of Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. Thanks to my co-host and legal expert, the wonderful Judge Elaine Andrews. And thank Chief Justice Craig Stauers for taking the time to be with us and take any question that came across
thank
the pipeline.
Thank you for asking me today.
Hometown Alaska takes holiday break next Wednesday, but returns to the air January 4th. Justice Alaska will air again on January 18th. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. Happy holidays, and thank you for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.